Something from yesterday's class. Who remembers something from yesterday's class?
Well, there were some people who were drinking the honey from Krishna's face, but there was enough for everybody and it never ended.
How sweet. Madhu. Thank you. Anyone else?
Offering pious credit, the people of Kunjanagaram, they were offering their pious credit to Rukmini in that moment of marriage. If they have done something good, they were telling that she will be married to Krishna. That way they are offering their pious credit to her.
Out of their affection for her. It's just so natural, the system of kings and queens and royal families that are trained and are people of integrity and principle. It's so natural for them to be loved by the people. It's just so natural. Anyone else? Yes.
In the early morning, Rukmini did not yet hear something of the Brahmin, the messenger from Krishna. And she was thinking maybe Krishna has found some condemnable quality in me, a bad quality, and it will not come. So she was full of anxiety.
But why did Krishna come? Of course he did.
She was thinking ahead of time.
Why did he come?
Because she had all the good
And because she was so devoted to him, and also he had appreciated her good qualities even prior to the letter. He even said, I could not sleep at night thinking about you.
When Rukmini Devi, she finished her worship to Balani, goddess Balani, she went out of the her temple, and she was walking through the small this corridor between the so many kings, and everybody started to look at her. She was looking so beautiful that the lust arises in their mind. As soon as lust arises in their mind, the lust covered their vision, and actually they perceived the external energy of the Lord, illusory energy of the Lord. They cannot see real Rukmini. And she just used this moment because she's Lakshmi Devi's expansion, Mahalakshmi, she's the expansion of Srimati Rukmini Devi. She used this moment and she looked around just to catch the glance of Lord.
And then she saw the face of Krishna for the first time, and she had only heard about him, and she had fallen in love just by hearing about Krishna, and there he was, and she knew it was him. Just, of course, we can't imagine her transcendental experience, but just imagine, nevertheless, how wonderful it would be, how wonderful it was for her to see Krishna in that way. Just when she was feeling so hopeless, it was so close to the time when everything would be ruined, and then she saw the smiling face of Krishna, and no anxiety about taking her. And how did the chapter end? Yes.
The kings are chasing after
they're so angry at Krishna for doing this. And they're saying that he is like this, because he's a coward boy. And we are kshatriyas, we are warriors. And he's stolen away this prize, just like a jackal or a puny animal may steal something from the lion. We will go and teach him a lesson. And therefore, the next chapter begins. Sukadeva Goswami said, having thus spoken, all those infuriated kings, what does infuriated mean?
Blessed.
Intensely angry. They donned their armor, they put their armor on, and they mounted their conveyances, they mounted their chariots, their horses, etc. And each king, bow in hand, was surrounded by his own army, as he went after Krishna. The commanders of the Yadava army, seeing the enemy racing to attack, turned to face them, and they stood firm, O king. They twanged their bows. They were not frightened by the approaching other armies. Sridhar Swami comments, from the first verse, he says, "We are condemned." That's what they were saying. They were full of anger. They put on their armor and they ran after Krishna. And the Yadavas stood firm, as we hear in the third verse. They mounted on the backs of horses, the shoulders of elephants, and the seats of chariots. These were the main conveyances, it appears. The enemy kings, expert with weapons, rained down arrows upon the Yadavas, like clouds pouring rain on a mountain. So what does the analogy mean? Like clouds pouring rain on a mountain.
Nothing happened.
Many arrows, but Krishna was not disturbed.
Yeah, this is the whole army. They stood firm, just like many arrows may, water may rain down on a mountain, but the mountain doesn't become disturbed and run away. Stands firm. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments on text 3 as follows. So it was quite a scene. There were exuberant warriors trying to kill Krishna and to retrieve Rukmini. They were exuberant. They were enthusiastic. Yes, we are kings, we are famous, and look at him. He's just a cowherd boy. Insignificant, their arrows appeared, as water coming onto a mountain. 4. Slender-waisted Rukmini, seeing her lord's army covered by a torrent of arrows, shyly looked at his face with fear-stricken eyes, because she was afraid. Look at this. How can Krishna, how can my lord, now he is my husband, how can he save himself and save us from the onslaught of the enemies who are trying to kill him by shooting out, and they have us outnumbered. In response to this, the Lord laughed. See, this is one thing that's quite interesting in a sense, that we know that Krishna is unlimitedly powerful. And we know that Krishna is not going to lose. So if there's a battle between two forces and you favor one force and the other side is so powerful, there is an anxiety caused in the consciousness, because one fears that the ones who one favors are going to be destroyed. But we know Krishna is not going to be destroyed. We know he's going to be victorious. So what is it? So in a mundane drama, it's the anxiety. Who's going to win? Who's going to win? What's going to happen? That anxiety holds our attention. But what holds one's attention when you know that Krishna's beforehand, that Krishna's going to win? One answer we heard, Krishna holds our attention. The reins of a horse, what else? I'm asking in like a personal way, what holds your attention? You know who's going to win.
How
he does it. And how does he do it? He does it in a humorous way. He does it in a wonderful way. He does it in a way with such grace as only the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who's a person, who's unlimitedly powerful, who's unlimitedly wonderful. So part of his unlimited wonderfulness is that he performs the most incredible pastimes, activities, in such a unique way. And this particular pastime is also really unique. And there's parts of it that I think are so humorous. And that part will come to fairly soon. this really, really, how Krishna has done this and what Balaram does and how Rukmi reacts. And then when we go on a bit further to the 61st chapter of this canto, what finally the end of, because here we're going to hear how Balaram comes to the rescue of Rukmi in his own way, and then Balaram's going to be the one who kills Rukmi later on because Rukmi gets him angry. And he does that in a wonderful way as well. So anyway, Rukmini looked at Krishna with fear, stricken eyes. So think about that. There is Rukmini, this newly first time seeing Krishna. She's heard about how powerful he is, and this army is attacking, and he's so beautiful. And she looks at him with complete fear, which means complete what? Dependence. Love, but dependence. And Krishna basically says, don't worry about a thing. Just watch what happens. So her love is increasing with every subtle and little dealing with Krishna because he is so wonderful. She shyly looked at his face because they were newly acquainted too. And this was an opportunity because of the difficulty of the... because naturally it would be hard for her out of her shyness, even though they were married, considered married at this time, but due to her natural shyness, she had never talked to him before. She had written him that bold letter. So maybe she was somewhat shy to look at him. But her fear caused her to break the bonds of the shyness and look at beautiful Krishna taking shelter of him. And he just laughed and he assured her. And in such a sweet way, because everything that Krishna does increases rasa and increases love. Listen to what he said. Do not be afraid, beautiful-eyed one. This enemy force is about to be destroyed by your soldiers. What is mine is yours. We'll read the beginning of this purport. To express his great affection for Rukmini, Lord Krishna gallantly referred to his own Yadava army as your men. Now they are yours. They are under your command. Because you have brought me under your control. Because you have asked me to come, and I have come. So you have controlled me, you have carried me so far from Dwarka. Now, indicating that the Lord's entire dynasty was now the property of his beloved queen. The Supreme Lord Krishna desires to share his blissful opulence with all living beings, and thus he sincerely invites them to come back home, back to Godhead. So this is really true, because as tiny souls, what is our capacity to enjoy independently of Krishna? But what Krishna wants, of course the answer to that is not very great, because we're tiny and insignificant, and we have experience of this continuously, how our attempts to enjoy, exploit the material energy, use the material energy for our pleasure, they certainly tend to fail, and we don't get the pleasure that we were dreaming of, because we are tiny and insignificant. But when that tiny soul connects through devotion to Krishna, then it's like the light bulb connecting to the electrical source, in the sense that then the power of the source, the power of Krishna, he bestows. The power of Krishna is actually Srimati Radharani, bestows upon us the Ladini Shakti, and then our power to enjoy increases even beyond the power of Krishna. And that's the secret of Braja that Mahaprabhu revealed as described in the fourth chapter of Adilila of Chaitanya Charitamrita, that he says, those who think, quoting Bharat Muni, Those who think that the lover and the beloved enjoy equally, they do not know my brother. So Krishna bestows upon the living entity, the tiny, insignificant living entity, the power to experience more bliss than even he experiences. So do not fear. Do not be afraid, O beautiful-eyed one, as she is now looking at Krishna with her eyes, fearful eyes, breaking through the bonds of her shyness. The enemy force is about to be destroyed by your soldiers, and he says it so sweetly. Then the heroes of the Lord's army, headed by Gada and Shankarshan. Who is Shankarshan?
Bala.
Yes, it is Baladev. Bala means strength. They could not tolerate the aggression of the opposing kings. If someone is aggressive to you, what will a weaker person do? He will become frightened. But a person who's powerful, a kshatriya, if someone acts in a heavy way, he becomes strong, angry. I will retaliate. So Balaram and company and the rest of the soldiers, they could not tolerate the aggression of the opposing kings who were charging towards them. We will chastise this coward community, Krishna Balaram. Thus with iron arrows they began to strike down the enemy's horses, elephants and chariots. Now this is really a good verse here if you have a kshatriya spirit. The heads of soldiers fighting on chariots, horses and elephants fell to the ground by the millions. So there were millions of heads on the ground. And some heads wore earrings and helmets and others turbans. But whether your head wears an earringed, or you have a helmet on your head or a turban on your head, it doesn't make any difference when you fight with Krishna and try to oppose Krishna. Your head will fall to the ground regardless of how it's decorated. And lying all around. Just imagine what this looked like. Maybe you shouldn't imagine what it looks like. Lying all around with thighs, legs, and fingerless hands, along with hands clutching swords, still clutching swords, cut off, clubs and bows, and also the heads of horses, donkeys, elephants, camels, wild asses, and humans. Vishnu Chakravarti, not a very pleasant scene. 9. Seeing their armies being struck down by the Vrishnis, who were eager for victory, the kings, headed by Jarasandha, were discouraged and left the battlefield. They're thinking, now why are we fighting? We're losing all our men. We're getting killed ourselves. For Sisubhal. Immediately, first their anger was directed towards Krishna, and they were losing, it came back. And they left the battlefield and headed towards Shishupal. The kings approached Shishupal, who was disturbed like a man who has lost his wife. Even then, the commentators here explained in the previous purport that even though Shishupal had not married Rukmini, he was already very attached to her. And when he lost her, he felt the discouragement and the disturbance of someone who had lost his own wife, even though in fact she was not his wife. He was devastated, destroyed. His heart ripped asunder, in a sense. His complexion was drained of color. His enthusiasm was gone. And his face appeared dried up. The kings spoke to him as follows. The kings, especially Jarasandha, it appears, said, "Oh Shishupal, listen, oh Shishupal, oh tiger among men," he's trying to encourage him, "give up your depression. After all, embodied beings' happiness and unhappiness is never seen to be permanent, oh king." That's an interesting concept, that just as our happiness, we say this, that our happiness in this world, Nateshu Ramate Buddha, a wise person does not delight in the happinesses of this world, which combine the senses and the sense object, because they are temporary. We have it, and then it will slip through our hands, and that causes frustration. So not only the happiness is temporary in this world, but also the distress is temporary. So Jarasandha reminds us, he's preaching to Shishupal, very philosophical here. After all, embodied beings' happiness and unhappiness is never seen to be permanent or king. He's encouraging him, you're a king. Just as a puppet in the form of a woman dances by the desire of the puppeteer, so in this world, controlled by the Supreme Lord, Ishvara Tantroyam, under the control of the Ishvara, the Supreme Lord, so the soul dancing and dancing by the in the hands of the higher powers, he struggles in both happiness and misery, but actually these things, his happiness and misery, are both out of his control. We are like puppets being manipulated by the three modes of material nature and ultimately by the Ishvara. Ishvara Tantroyam Ihate Sukadukkaya. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Short comment. Just as puppets are controlled by the puppeteer, so the living entities receive happiness and distress under the direction of the Lord. Thus we see that even though the demons, Jarasandha, accept the power of God, they are demoniac because of being inimical to Krishna. So one has to admit it's quite humorous in one sense. And we see this in other places of the Bhagavatam. Someone like Jarasandha, who is very, very, very pious, a great devotee of Lord Shiva, a powerful Kshatriya, but yet he was inimical to Krishna. And despite possessing so many wonderful qualities, that one quality of aversion to Krishna puts him in the category of an asura. And simultaneously, if a person has the one quality of being, of having turned to Krishna and have surrendered to Krishna, even if he doesn't have any other good qualities, that person is a great soul. Or that soul is a great soul. A great soul. But that is not Jarasandha. 13. And he's giving an example. In battle with Krishna, I and my 23 armies lost 17 times, and only once did I defeat him. But still I never lament or rejoice, because I know this world is driven by time and fate. This is very wonderful, practical, important preaching, in fact, even though it is spoken through the mouth of Jarasandha, that we lament that which is not worthy of our grief, in fact, because we're attached to things that are beyond our control, and therefore we lament. But these things are in the hands of the Lord. So does that mean that we should not do anything? Like the python doesn't go anywhere, we should just open our mouth and see what goes into it and not even lift the fork or spoon or our fingers to our mouth to put the food in? And if Krishna wants, he'll feed us. And if Krishna doesn't want, then what could we do anyway? Can we use, what do you think about that philosophy? Of course, the Agarajara, Dattatreya Muni, he acted on that level actually, and therefore he astounded Yudhisthira Maharaj, because he wasn't endeavoring for eating even the slightest bit, and yet he was plump. So how is this possible? So then he explained. But what is our philosophy on this point? Should we, if we say we shouldn't endeavor, how much do you want to take that? How far do you want to take it? Does that mean, again, you don't even lift, the food is before you, but if Krishna wants it to go into my mouth, or maybe I shouldn't even open my mouth. If Krishna wants it to go into my stomach, he'll put it in my stomach. How far should we take this philosophy?
Krishna was asked this question in Mahabharata, so he said,
of the two, action is more important. Action and faith, the karma and Yishka, he said that karma is more important. And in Uttapadesh, there is this famous statement which said, Mahisu Kasa Simhasya, Ravishanti Mukambriga, that the rabbits do not jump into the mouth of a sleeping lion, even though it's his allotted quota to eat, it's hairs, hairs. So the hairs still, he has to chase them, he has to catch them.
Yes.
So the example given there is the chariot has two wheels. One is the destiny, the other one is the endeavor. And of the two, the endeavor is more important because it forms the destiny.
And then when we're endeavoring for something and it doesn't happen, then we evoke the other principle. Then anyway, it's not my fate. And it's true. I've heard Prabhupada comment on this because sometimes he preaches with that, like with that verse, Tasyaiva Hetu, Prayate Kovito, that something, what things, happiness and distress, they come of their own, so why endeavor for any happiness at all? So you could take this to the extreme, like we're doing, and say, okay, I won't make any endeavor at all. But then I also heard Prabhupada say, in case he said, but some little minimum endeavor has to be there, and that's the system. And in addition to that, what really, where this philosophy is perfected is that one does one's duty, and that's the motivating force for the action, not to get the particular result of happiness and distress. And where it really reaches its perfection, so not that I'm just acting for my pleasure, that's one level. Then the second level is I'm acting because I'm supposed to act in that way. This is my duty. And then the highest level, of course, I'm acting to please Krishna. And then whatever the results are, that's up to Krishna.
In that verse, you just quote, Asena Heta Prayateta Korido, it doesn't say that one should not endeavor to have this distress. It says one should endeavor. Asena Heta Prayateta Korido.
For something, yes. And then also, one of the factors of action, mentioned in the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is the Lord, the Supersoul. And perhaps that's the ultimate factor. Not perhaps. The Lord's sanction, because he is the Anumanta, the permitter. So his sanction is the ultimate cause of acceptance the ultimate cause of the result. But still there are other factors in action, and one of them is the chesta, or the endeavor, the senses, etc. Okay, let's go on. But it's an interesting point. I always find this philosophical point interesting. But yes.
So the more endeavor then is when your consciousness is actually taken away from Krishna.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Can we say that an over-endeavor is when we...
What was the first part?
Can we say, yes. An over-endeavor is when we lose our focus on Krishna.
I think that would be one example. Say if you're focused on Krishna and you're working in such a way to please Krishna, you're talking about we meaning a devotee, then it's okay. But if your mind becomes so distracted you're unable to think about Krishna, I guess you could say that's not so favorable. But sometimes in an emergency, like there's a war going on and you have to do some specific service so that your armies don't become completely destroyed, you just have to do it anyway because it's an emergency. Because that's what really just has to be done, and rely on Krishna to protect you in your imperfect execution of your duty. But as a general principle, we should try to remember why mam anusmara yudhyacha. We should remember why we're doing what we're doing. Chaitasya sarva kamani maya sanyasi mayapara. We're trying to do something for the pleasure of Guru and Gauranga and Radhisham. Is that all right?
So Prabhupada said that to one devotee that to hell with your consciousness. What about my consciousness problems? I think it's a bit high pitch. He told him to eat meat. Necessarily, he should eat meat, you know, if he wants to do a specific service in Russia. And so, what about my consciousness? He says, to hell with your consciousness.
Right, but where Prabhupada get that specific example from, that you should even eat meat if required, and that for this to get this started, because Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that the mood of anything to please Krishna, even if it takes something so extreme and irregular as that, if Krishna is going to be pleased by it, we'll do it, even for that. But he was making a specific point rather than, doesn't make a difference what our consciousness is like when we're trying to do our service or etc., etc. But sometimes in an extreme emergency, that can't be the ultimate consideration. Or emergency means an extreme. Tricky point. So when to evoke the extreme emergency clause, that one needs wisdom for, and you can't use it too many times either, or else that becomes the standard. Okay. This is the Jarasandha Gita we're reading from. So, time and fate, and now all of us, great commanders of military leaders, have been defeated by the Yadus and their small entourage who are protected by Krishna. Now our enemies have conquered because time favors them. But in the future, when time is auspicious for us, we shall conquer. We shall conquer. So this also comes up with when Indradev is told by Brihaspati, now it is time to just admit defeat by the attacking forces of Bali Maharaj, because time is against us. So one has to know, be able to understand what kind of activity is suitable for the times. When it's time to press forward and time to pull back. There's an old martial arts saying that there's no difference between attack and retreat, because the purpose is the same, to defeat the enemy. So when one, and in Chinese martial arts, it's always like this, pushing back and pushing forward, because that's part of life. And when the tide of your life is moving forward, that is the time to really push strongly. And if it's time to go back and you push strongly, you will get knocked over. So he's trying to reassure Shishupala in these terms. So Sukadeva Goswami said, thus persuaded by his friends, Shishupal took his followers and went back to his capital. The surviving warriors also returned to their respective cities. So it is over now. Krishna has kidnapped Rukmini. Is it over? No. Because powerful Rukmi was especially envious of Krishna, because he was the one who had arranged Krishna to marry, Rukmini to marry Shishupala against everyone's desire. Because of his enmity, envy of Krishna, he could not bear the fact that Krishna had carried off his sister to marry her in the Rakshasa style. Thus he pursued the Lord with one Akshohini, an entire military division. Frustrated and enraged, mighty armed Rukmi, dressed in armor and wielding his bow, he was enraged. And enraged persons sometimes have amazing power due to their anger. He had sworn before all the kings, I shall not again enter Kundina if I do not kill Krishna in battle and bring Rukmini back with me. I swear this to you. So he was enraged, and now he had made a promise, I shall not come back to my capital city if I do not kill Krishna and bring Rukmini back. So he's putting his whole existence, his life, his fame on the line. Because the others came back. But Rukmini said, I will not come back. Having said this, so this motivates one. Just like it is said that when they there was a very difficult battle coming up, and the Vikings had traveled from where? Scandinavia to England to defeat. Yes, the hordes, and they burned their boats. There was no turning back, so therefore it was either victory or death. Who won? The Vikings won. Oh, yes. Who did you say won? Okay. A little country spirit coming out. Nationalistic spirit. So having said this in his own Kshatriya spirit, and their lives were at stake here, he had mounted his chariot and told his charioteer, drive the horses quickly to where Krishna is. He and I must fight. This wicked-minded cowherd boy, infatuated, means enamored, means intoxicated with his prowess, with his power, has violently abducted, stolen away my sister. But today I will remove his pride with my sharp arrows. Bold words, and many, many asuras have spoken bold words to Krishna, only to have their heads separated from their bodies. Here's the comment of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. Today, Rukmi said, today with my sharp arrows I will remove the heroic pride of that stupid coward boy who has forcibly abducted my sister. From the viewpoint of Goddess Saraswati, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur is very expert at breaking the words differently and turning the meaning to mean some praise of Krishna when a criticism has been intended. So he has retranslated, broken the words differently and retranslated it as follows. Today the intoxication of pride I have in my own prowess will be removed by the sharp arrows of the coward boy whose beautiful mind is compassionate even towards the wicked. Boasting thus. What does boasting mean? Bragging. Talking of one's own power. Foolish Rukmi, ignorant of the true extent of the Supreme Lord's power, approached Lord Govinda in his lone chariot and challenged him, just stand and fight. Rukmi drew his bow with great strength and struck Lord Krishna with three arrows. Then he said, stand here for a moment, O defiler of the Yadu dynasty. So he got off the first arrows and hit Krishna. 24, we'll read the comment of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, and we'll get the reverse translation and what it means. Kulapamsana can mean, O defiler of your dynasty. But according to the inspiration of Saraswati, Kulapamsana may be understood as a combination of the words Kula and Pa. Kula Pa, O protector of the Yadu dynasty, and Amsana, O expert killer of enemies. Atra Chanam Tishta can mean stand here for a moment. It can also mean Ara Ikshanam Tishta, stand so that I may glance at you. Because Krishna was very beautiful. 25. Wherever you go, Rukmini said, because he's just struck with three arrows. Wherever you go, carrying off my sister like a crow stealing sacrificial butter, I will follow. This very day I shall relieve you of your false pride. You fool, you deceiver, you cheater in battle. Oh. We know his words will not last very long. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Rukmi said, you are taking my sister like a crow steals a sacrificial offering. Today, O fool, I will take away your pride in being a false warrior and cheater. The other meaning is, since my sister is Mahalakshmi and thus belongs to you, whether you steal her or not, wherever you go, she is your own essence, sa saram. After releasing my sister from you, I will bring her back to my house, just as a crow steals the sacrificial butter. Please break the pride of this false warrior, myself, who is a fool and a cheater. So that's the opposing meaning that glorifies Krishna. More truthful, more accurate. 26. Release the girl before you are struck dead by my arrows and made to lie down. In response to this, Lord Krishna smiled, and with 6 arrows he struck Rukmi and broke his bow. The Lord struck Rukmi's 4 horses with 8 arrows, his chariot driver with 2, his chariot flag with 3. Rukmi grabbed another bow and struck Krishna with 5 arrows. Although hit by these many arrows, Lord Achyuta again broke Rukmi's bow. Rukmi picked up yet another bow, but the infallible Lord broke that one to pieces as well. From iron bludgeons, 3-pointed spears. What's a 3-pointed spear called? Yes, a trishul. Here is patisham. Sword and shield and pike, long spike thing with a hook at the end. Javelin, whatever weapon Rukmi picked up, Lord Hari smashed it into bits. Then Rukmi leaped down from his chariot. He was so angry. And sword in hand, he rushed furiously towards Krishna to kill him with his sword, and like a bird flying into the wind. And as Rukmi attacked him, the Lord shot arrows that broke Rukmi's sword and shield into small pieces. Krishna then took up his own sharp sword and prepared to kill Rukmi. Now, what is going to happen? Will Krishna kill Rukmi? What do you think?
No.
What do you think? No. He'll leave that for Balaram later on. No. Because seeing the Lord ready to kill her brother, saintly Rukmini was filled with alarm. She fell at her husband's feet and piteously spoke as follows. So this is quite an interesting beginning to a marriage. This is what Rukmini's... this is the comment of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. Rukmini thought, what will people think if they know that my brother was killed before my eyes? She was filled with fear because of this, not out of affection for her brother. The prema of the queens of Dwarka, known as Samanjasa prema, proper love, is dependent on public opinion. Whereas the prema of the Vrajagopis, known as Samarta prema, is much stronger because it is not dependent at all on the opinion of the public. It does not matter what people think. Samanjasa prema and Samarta prema. However, one should not think that the general characteristic of prema, namely the exclusive possessiveness of Vishnu in a loving relationship, is lacking in Rukmini. Since within herself she actually had no affection at all for Rukmi and other demons like him. This will be described later in detail. Exclusive possessiveness is explained in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. When one is completely apathetic to all other objects and has developed an exclusive sense of ownership or possessiveness in relationship to Lord Vishnu, thinking of Vishnu and no one else as his object of love, such an awakening is called prema bhakti by Bhishma, Prahlad, Uddhav, and Narada. So that's the definition of prema bhakti. And because Rukmini possessed so much prema, so Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has showed us in a wonderful way how her stopping Krishna from killing Rukmini did not actually did not mean that she had love for him, which would contradict the definition of prema. Quite wonderful. So brilliant. So Rukmini, in one verse, speaks to protect, pleads for her brother's life. Rukmini said, O controller of all mystic power, immeasurable one, Lord of Lords, so controller of all mystic power, immeasurable one, Lord of Lords, three qualities of Krishna, master of the universe, four, O all auspicious and mighty arm one, 5, 6, please do not kill my brother. She's pleading with him. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains the meaning of these specific six glorifications of Krishna as follows. Rukmini said, you possess inconceivable great transcendental opulence. Well, Rukmi is the most insignificant of those who are controlled by you. You are the immeasurable one, and he is like an insect amongst the limited. You are supreme amongst the demigods, and he is the lowest amongst humans because he's inimical to you. You are the protector of the universe, and though he is evil because he is within the universe, he is to be protected. Therefore, O auspicious one, with mighty arms, you should not kill this inauspicious person with no power in his arms. So she's pleading for Krishna to be merciful. 34. So how is Krishna going to respond? Sukadeva Goswami said, Rukmi's utter fear caused her limbs to tremble and her mouth to dry up, because she was only a little girl. While her throat choked up out of sorrow, so her limbs trembled, her mouth dried up, and her throat choked up out of sorrow. And in her agitation, her golden necklace scattered. She grasped Krishna's feet, and the Lord, feeling compassionate, desisted. He stopped. Purport. What did he stop? He stopped. He didn't kill Rukmi. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes the worldly rule that one's sister is the personification of mercy. Dayaya Bhagani Murti. Even though Rukmi was wicked and was opposed to his sister's best interest, Rukmini was compassionate towards him, and the Lord shared her compassion. 35. So this is what Krishna did. His sword was out already. He was about to kill him. Rukmini grabbed his lotus feet, Krishna's feet, and begged him not to kill Rukmi. And what did Krishna do? Lord Krishna tied up the evil doer, that's Rukmi, with a strip of cloth. He then proceeded to disfigure Rukmi by comically shaving him, leaving part of his mustache and hair. By that time, the Yadav heroes had crushed the extraordinary army of their opponents, just as elephants crush a lotus flower. So two things are being described here. That the Yadav heroes have defeated their enemies, all the other armies, including the army of Rukmi. And Krishna's binding up Rukmi and then with his sword cutting him, cutting his beard and his mustache, but not just shaving him clean and making him look funny, because if he did that, gave him a good clean shave, what would happen in 2 weeks or 3 weeks? It would all grow back. And then Krishna wanted Rukmi to remember this, and he wanted everyone, when they looked at Rukmi, to also know that Krishna had done this. Be careful. This is what happens. So here, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes what Krishna actually did. He describes it as follows. Rukmi should never come and do mischief again. Thinking thus, Krishna showed his contempt for Rukmi by marking his body with some ugly features to let him remember his defeat and dissolve his pride. Krishna tied him up by the neck with a strip of cloth using his left hand, while holding up the two ends of that cloth. Krishna took his sword in his right hand, knocked off Rukmi's turban, and then shaved off bits of his mustache, beard, and hair at the root. In other words, he cut it out. He didn't just shave it with his sword. He cut it out, leaving scars and taking out the roots of the hair. And he drew blood. And with scraps of hair remaining here and there, Rukmi looked bloody and completely disfigured. And he would remember this. But as we see it with the demoniac mentality, even though a person, and I see this with myself, unfortunately I have to admit it, but Krishna shows me time and time again, don't do this kind of a thing. And he leaves his own little scars in there, so we remember that, we recognize we shouldn't do this. But still the demonic nature, the averse, the nature of someone averse to Krishna, he tries again to occupy the position of the controller and the enjoyer, and then he has to suffer. And eventually he will try this on Balaram. Krishna is exceptionally merciful to him here because of Rukmini's prayers. But when he tries to give Balaram trouble, Balaram is going to become angry and he's going to kill him. So Krishna disfigured him in a very heavy way, scarred him for life. 36. So the other thing that was going on again, the Yadus had just defeated Sankarsan, and the other Yadus had defeated all the other armies. And as the Yadus approached Lord Krishna, they saw Rukmi in this sorry condition, all tied up, practically dying of shame because he had gone out there so boldly and with such a promise. But now he had been defeated and shamed, and for a Kshatriya, this is worse than death. So therefore that English expression that's used, he was practically dying of shame. When the all-powerful Lord Balaram saw Rukmi, he compassionately released him and spoke the following to Lord Krishna. So Balaram released Rukmi, which is even more of an insult, that he couldn't release himself, but someone said, we should be compassionate to this poor fellow. So what an insult for a Kshatriya. And Balaram took the cloth that Krishna was holding in his left hand and released Rukmi from the noose, from that cloth. It's actually a very good way of tying someone up with cloth. Very hard to get out. Like this, around one's neck, one's arms in the back, and one can't do anything, one's legs. And Balaram said, now here's something very interesting. What is Balaram going to say here? Now here they are, Krishna has just kidnapped Rukmini, his first wife, and Krishna and this Rukmi, who is so inimical to Krishna, he was the one who caused the whole problem anyway for forcibly trying to marry Rukmini to Shishupal, and Rukmi has been disfigured. Now what is Balaram going to say in this? So it's divided into two parts. He's going to try to pacify everyone, and he's going to give moral instructions, which are true and practical, rajniti. And then he's going to, in the middle of this whole scene, speak gyan, philosophy, in the middle of a battlefield with first marriage. And he's going to speak it to Rukmini, who's grieving because her brother has been disfigured, and he's going to speak gyan to her. So we can understand also that this gyan is not only meant for Rukmini, and perhaps it's not even really meant for Rukmini, but we should listen to it very, very carefully. We should listen to it very carefully. Why? Why do we? Because we don't. If we're interested in enough in Bhagavad Katha to have reached the 10th canto, in one sense, the last thing one is expecting is gyan again spoken in a battlefield. That was the Bhagavad Gita part of that. But if one actually wishes to gain something higher, one has to be careful about entanglement in lower things, because that can upturn the boat of our spiritual journey, and we end up in the ocean of material existence if we're not careful. So first, the first part of what Baladeva is going to say, he's going to give some practical moral instructions, and in this way, he's going to be speaking to Krishna Rukmini, and in this way pacify Rukmini, who's disturbed. So, 37 to 42, that's six verses of these practical moral instructions. Lord Balaram said, "My dear Krishna, you have acted improperly. This deed will bring shame on us. For to disfigure a close relative by shaving off his mustache and hair is as good as killing him. He's our relative." One has to act very carefully dealing with relatives. Saintly lady, we'll read all these verses first. "Please do not be displeased with us out of anxiety for your brother's disfigurement. No one but oneself is responsible for one's joy and grief, for a man experiences the result of his own deeds." So that's so ironical in one sense. Why? Because Jarasandha, who's a demon, speaks that everything depends on the Ishwara. And the supreme Ishwara, Balaram, says everything is your fate, everything is your karma only. That's going to bring the result. So there's... I found this part quite humorous in its own way, because just the scene, Rukmi's there, he's still tied up, Balaram's releasing him and he's speaking, chastising Krishna for doing this, trying to appease Rukmini, and then speaking this completely intellectual jnana that will come later. But first, again, here's the moral philosophy. No one but oneself is responsible for one's joy and grief. So keep that in mind as you go through life. This point of view, when something happens to us that we don't like, we should understand that it is a result of our karma. It is a result of our karma. One has to be wise enough to pull the right philosophical point for the appropriate time. It's not the time when something bad is happening, quote, bad is happening, to say this is God who's doing this to me, this is the Ishwara, but it's the time for this point. A man experiences the result of his own deeds. So he's telling Rukmini that what's happened, Krishna, he says, shouldn't have done this. To Rukmini, he says, listen, what Rukmini has acted, he's getting the reactions for how he's acted. 39, again addressing Krishna, then he turns to Krishna again. A relative should not be killed. And even if his wrongdoing warrants capital punishment, rather he should be thrown out of the family, since he has already been killed by his own sin. Why kill him again? Spare him. So he's saying here that consciousness of one's fault, I mean, to some degree he's saying this is that if one becomes conscious of something that he's... when something happens to one, if one is conscious this is due to my reactions and one feels bad about that, that is its own repentance. No need to get punished again if one actually feels bad about getting a reaction for something that one has actually done improperly. Turning then to Rukmini again. So spare him. He's already feeling bad. He understands. But he actually didn't understand. Then Balaram's going to say, because here he's saying, what is the need to kill him? Because he's understood his faults, he's embarrassed, he's humiliated. But later on, when he's going to be dealing with Balaram, Balaram's going to find a need to kill him, because clearly he's kept his enmity and he's blamed Krishna and Balaram for everything, and Balaram himself is going to kill him. So he turns to Rukmini again and said, and also notice how Balaram... he's further insulting Rukmi by not even talking to Rukmi. He's talking to Krishna, he's talking to Rukmini about this poor fellow who's tied up over here, just insulting him even more. The code of sacred duty, this is to Rukmini, for warriors established by Lord Brahma, enjoins that one may have to kill even one's own brother. That is indeed a most dreadful law, but this is the way Kshatriyas act. Again, Balarama, now he turns to Krishna. Blinded by, then he condemns Kshatriyas. He says, this is the way Kshatriyas act. What do? Blinded by conceit with their personal opulence, proud men offend others for the sake of such things as kingdom, land, wealth, women, honor, and power. So for material gain, these people become very, very ruthless. So he said he's talking to Krishna in that way. So proud. So Krishna at least didn't kill him. And then he turns to Rukmini. Your attitude is unfair. Now he's going to, after he's said, don't worry about it, and chastise Krishna, now he's going to lightly chastise Rukmini herself, because he is elder brother. He can do that. Elder brother has the position like father. Your attitude is unfair, for like an ignorant person, you wish good to those who are inimical to all living beings and who have done evil to your own true well-wisher. Own well-wisher. So he's tried to kill Krishna. So you're just being sentimental and you're feeling bad that he's been punished. And then we move now to the philosophical points, the jnana. This is what Balaram says. The Supreme Lord's maya makes men forget their real selves. And thus taking the body for the self, they consider others to be friends, enemies, or neutral parties. We consider ourself the body, and then immediately, bewildered by maya, that lines up everyone else in the world into friends and enemies, etc. And just through the acceptance of body. This is as the self, and this is the effect of maya. And now an example of that in text 44. Those who are bewildered perceive the one supreme soul who resides in all embodied beings as many, just as one may perceive the light in the sky or the sky itself as many. So this is an example in text 44 of, like he's giving the example of sky and fire. They are essentially the same, all the different manifestations in the sky. They appear to be different, but they're actually just sky. And all the different kinds of fire, there may be the fire flames may be in this shape or they may be in that shape. But really, essentially, they are just fire. So he's making the point, and there are different ways to explain this verse, that there's a soul. And the soul may be in seemingly in different shapes, in different bodies, but actually, it's just the soul. Essentially, the soul and every body are the same. There is a oneness, not necessarily oneness that it is all one, but they're all essentially the same. They're all souls regardless of the body. So that's an example of what maya makes us do, makes us see all differences. And indeed, this is so essential for devotees because Kapila Muni explains that to disrespect the different bodies that the souls are in, disrespect on that level is not pleasing to Krishna. And even if one respects the deity, if one doesn't respect the living entities. 45. So we identify fully with the body and become illusioned and make our friends and enemies according to who's in what kind of a body and under what modes of material nature. But actually, in 45, Lord Balaram says there is no true connection between the soul and body at all, which is quite amazing if you think about it. There is no connection between the soul, who I am, and this body, which I am not, but I'm thinking of myself as the body continuously, and there is no connection at all. That's what he says in this verse. And what is the connection will be described a little bit later. So in 45 he says, the material body, this material body, which has a beginning and an end, is composed of the physical elements, the senses, and the modes of nature. The body imposed on the self by material ignorance causes one to experience the cycle of birth and death. So due to this identification, even though we don't have anything to do with the body, we have to experience samsara, the blazing fire of samsara dhava nalalila loka, the forest fire of material existence, which includes birth and death. But there is no connection, in fact. 46. O intelligent lady, the soul never undergoes any contact with or separation from the insubstantial material objects, because the soul is their very origin and illuminator. Thus the soul resembles the sun, which neither comes in contact with nor separates from the sense of sight and what is seen. So there, again, the same point, that there is another example, that there is no... the sun's production of many... the sun is the production of many byproducts. In the same way as the soul's interaction with the body causes many byproducts. But as the sun is different from the objects that are seen, and as the sun is different from the eyesight itself, similarly the soul in the body, the soul which is within the body, has nothing to do with the byproducts or the things produced by the body. 47. Birth and other transformations are undergone by the body, but never by the self. Just as change, this is in the middle of the battlefield. This lady has just gotten married, kidnapped, and there's been this horrific war, and her brother's just been disfigured, and she's looking at Krishna, and she's only, how old? 13, 14, 15 years old, something like that. And Balaram is speaking this very, very high jnana type of philosophy about the difference between the soul and the body. Quite amazing on this battlefield with him standing there chastising Krishna, chastising Rukmini, acting as the older brother. He's never even met Rukmini before. This is practically her introduction to him. Another example. Birth and other transformations are undergone by the body, but never by the self. Just as change occurs for the moon's phases, but never for the moon. Though the new moon day may be called the moon's death, actually the moon remains the same. So similarly, the soul remains the same. Another example, so he's using one example after another, that the appearance and disappearance of the body have nothing to do with the soul, in the same way that the moon's changing phases have nothing to do with the moon. The moon, despite appearances, remains the same. As a sleeping person perceives himself, another example to make the same point, that the soul is eternal. And what is the eternal life of the soul? It is not with the body. He doesn't speak about what the life of the actual life of the soul is, but that's what we've been hearing about for the last 43 chapters, practically speaking. The real life of the soul in eternity, the life of the soul in the temporary, is the life of identification in illusion caused by Maya. A life of identification of the body and that which is produced by the body. But this is the life of the soul. This is what we've been hearing. The life of the soul in the realm of eternity, in relationship with Krishna, exchanging our own personal rasa with Krishna, and being uplifted to the highest realm of ecstasy by loving service to Krishna. And instead, in illusion, in Maya, we try to identify with the body and Bhungte Prakriti Janiha Karanam Guna Sangasya Sadasat Joni Janmasu. It's not a worthwhile trade into the ocean of material life. And then 48, another example, and this one is because we're saying there's no connection between the soul and the body at all, which is amazing. Well, then why is it that I experience always that I'm my body then if there's no connection? I mean, I don't experience that the same way about the table or this. If the body has no life and this has no life, the lamp has no life, and why don't I experience that as me? But of course, indeed we do. If it is mine, that's the expansion of me, the taking of sense of self and projecting it upon something that is not actually us. It's called mine. the sense of self. It's me and then it's mine. But with the body, there's such an intense identification. So Krishna's going to speak briefly about that in text 48, or Balaram. As the sleeping person perceives himself, the objects of sense enjoyment, and the fruits of his acts within the illusion of a dream, he experiences a whole life, a feeling of existence in a dream. So one who is unintelligent undergoes material existence. So Balaram is saying, it is just a dream, and we experience this all the time. The misplacing of the sense of the self upon something that isn't us, as opposed to something that is us. It's dream life, it's caused by Maya, it is illusion. And then finally, Balaram says, therefore, with transcendental knowledge, because Rukmini was in so much grief that her brother was defeated in such a difficult position, with transcendental knowledge, he is not your brother, the body is not you. Dispel the grief that is weakening and confounding your mind. Please resume your natural mood, or Suchi Smriti, O you whose smile is pure, O princess of the pristine smile. I'll read the comment of Srila Jiva Goswami where he, on that last, on 49. Oh, the meaning of, oh, you whose Suchi Smriti, whose smile is pure. Or in other words, Jiva Goswami says, oh, you whose heart is satisfied. Because it's so interesting in the commentary, he says it so briefly. So he says, in other words, your smile is pure, oh, you whose heart is satisfied. But he doesn't explain the connection between the smile being pure and the heart being satisfied. But it is a fact, and everyone really knows this, and one has a full-hearted, open smile. One can only do that when in fact one's heart is satisfied. When one's in a bad mood and one's feeling dissatisfied, the hardest thing in the world to do is smile. And if someone tries to make us smile when we don't want to smile, what happens to that person? Yes, and if he grows another head, we'll chop that one off too. We'll fix him. But then he explains further, because you are Lakshmi herself, you are never touched by any of these in the least. But it is your pastime as a person of this world that you are behaving like this. This is Jiva Goswami's comment. And in the same manner, I am also giving you this instruction. So Srila Jiva Goswami puts this into a greater perspective, saying this is just pastimes of the Lord. Sukadev Goswami said, thus enlightened by Lord Balaram, slender Rukmini forgot her depression and steadied her mind by spiritual intelligence. There's a nice comment by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur on this verse. No, where it is. Okay, anyway, Vishwanath comments simply. Rukmini composed herself by giving up the depression of thinking, what will people say about me? So, very interesting. She didn't, it says, because in the beginning Vishwanath commented her pleading for Rukmini was based on that point, saying that she actually didn't have affection for him because he was a demon. But she thought it wouldn't be appropriate because of her, what was it, someone just above, caring about what public opinion was. So here she gave that up based on philosophy. But the gopis gave that up based on intensity of their love. Which were the two again? Samanjasa?
Samantapri and Samarkapri.
What were they? Say it again in a way I can understand it. Samanjasa?
Samantasa. Samartha.
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 So which is which?
Samantasa is a queen's moon.
Yeah, Samanjasa.
And Samarkapri is the moon of gopis.
Oh, okay. Left with only his life air, this is Rukmi, cast out by his enemies and deprived of his strength and bodily radiance, Rukmi could not forget how he had been disfigured. So, rather than learning from his punishment, he became angrier. In frustration, he constructed for his residence a large city, which he called Bhojakata. Is there any comment on the meaning of Bhojakata? Anyone know anything about that? Adi, you have anything on that?
Yes, where somebody takes his experiences, his vows.
Hmm. Is that the literal meaning of it?
Yes. Vishwanath Chakravarti means Bhojakata, place where one experiences his own vow, taking own
vow. It doesn't say it here in this comment. This is what I've read of Vishwanath.
Purport of verse 52.
Okay. Yes, in 52. Expelled by his enemies means that Rukmi was insulted by the Yadu soldiers with abuses, curses, chastisements. They drove him out and insulted him as he walked away from Krishna. Because he had promised, "I will not re-enter Kundina until I have killed wicked Krishna and brought back my younger sister," in a mood of angry frustration, Rukmi took up residence at that very place. Comment by Vishwanath. Rukmi constructed a large city which he named Bhojakata. According to the Nanartavarga dictionary, the word Bhoja means experience and the word Kata means vow. Thus, Bhojakata is the place where Rukmi experienced misery as a result of his vow to offer Rukmini to Shishupala. Thus, defeating all the opposing kings, the Supreme Personality of Godhead brought the daughter of Bhishmaka to his capital and married her according to the Vedic injunctions, O protector of the Kurus. At that time, O king, there was a great rejoicing in the home of Yadupuri, whose citizens loved only Krishna, the chief of the Yadus. All the men and women full of joy, adorned with shining jewels and earrings, brought wedding presents, which they reverently offered to the exquisitely dressed groom and bride. And they gave him, as they do tend to do on this very day for their marriage, they gave him household utensils to the bride and groom, worthy gifts, things that they could practically use in their house. And of course, this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who just mystically, he's going to do it. He created the whole city of Dwarka. He had that done, and then he's going to create 16,108 palaces. And what do they give him? What do you give the man who has 16,001 household utensils? What do you give him for his wedding? Of course, some pots and some spoons and things like that. So it's funny in its own way. The city of the Vrishnis appeared most beautiful. There were tall festive columns and also archways decorated with flower garlands, cloth banners, and precious gems. Arrangements of auspicious for water pots, agaru-scented incense, and lamps graced every doorway. And the banners reached, Vishwanath said, up to the city of Lord Indra. They were very high. The city streets were cleansed by the intoxicated elephants belonging to the beloved kings who were guests at the wedding, and these elephants further enhanced the beauty of the city by placing trunks of plantain and betel nut trees in all the doorways. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, streets were sprinkled with the mudra from the elephants of the friendly kings attending the weapon, and the doorways were ornamented with tall banana and betel nut trees. Betel nut trees are like big palm trees. They're quite tall. Palm trees, coconut trees, almost the same size and looking. Those who belonged to the royal families of the Kurus, Shrinjai Kaikei, Vidarbha, Yadu, and Kunti clans joyfully met one another in the midst of the crowd of people excitedly running here and there, and they rejoiced. The kings and daughters were totally astonished to hear the story of Rukmini's abduction, which was being glorified in song everywhere, and Dwarka's citizens were overjoyed to see Krishna, the lord of all opulence, united with Rukmini, the goddess of fortune. Now, let me just check for a moment. Any questions or comments on this? Yes.
Why is it considered so condemnable to kill a relative?
Why is it considered condemnable to kill a relative? You mean in general?
Yeah, according to this Nitya Shastra.
Why is it condemnable to kill a relative like your mother or your father or your husband or your wife? I wonder what. Well, looking at it from the philosophical point of view, you mean? Yeah, from the philosophical point of view, if we look at it from the point of view that everyone's a soul, yes, we can kill anyone, no problem. But from the point of view of what of moral behavior, naturally there's affection in one's that one shares with one's relatives. And to kill someone who one has affection for means, obviously, either you're very angry or you have a very, very hard heart.
How can you kill someone if you have affection for them? It's not possible.
Unless your heart is very, very bad.
And if you have a bad heart, you don't have affection for them.
But they, yes, but we're talking about the relatives. So what were you exactly asking? That's what you wanted to ask. That if you have affection for, in anger, one can do anything, and this happens all the time nowadays in this crazy material world. That it's especially sinful. Those who one naturally, by Krishna's psychological arrangement, one naturally has affection for. If one harms those same people, it's very, very bad. It's bad for the society. It's because you can't trust anyone, that means. And this isn't on exactly on the spiritual level, this instruction. It's on the practical daily level of how to live your life. So we should have affection and relationship with family members. We should. That's healthy. That's psychologically healthy. It's not the purpose of life. The purpose of life is to learn how to love Krishna, because all the family members will one day leave this world. But this instruction isn't on that level. This is like a vanashrama type of instruction.
So maybe because they are the ones who have been taken care of us.
Of course, gratefulness, you have a relationship with them. But even this, yeah, it's such a simple point, yes? I mean, why don't we? Yeah, once you, and we see in Kali Yuga, in previous times, even especially you saw this in India, or all over the world, you know, families that became very powerful and wealthy in India, they had so many brothers who cooperated. So many of the wealthy families were like that. Why? Because you can trust your family members that they're not going to cheat you. They tell you they're going to do something, you can rely on them, but someone else from outside you can't rely on in the same way. That's the point. So this is just for natural, healthy, on the psychological, practical vanashrama living level. It's such an obvious point that you have a friend that you meet and you make and you really like them, but then in a few years something happens and they're gone. But with family, it's not supposed to be like that. People take care of each other. Even if there's disagreement, for the sake of keeping the family together, things are overlooked. And yeah, so it's not so. Therefore, people will have security in their life. At least someone's there to take care of me. You know, even if something bad happens. If I'm in difficulty, people turn to their family. So nowadays in Kali Yuga, even, I don't think this was the point that you were asking that from, but nowadays in Kali Yuga, even that simple human security isn't available to people. And you know, the parents conspire to have an abortion and kill the children, and there's lawsuits between brothers and on and on and on and on and on and on, and brothers and sisters and family breakups and the children. So even the basic human existence is becoming more and more rare. I know some people in Jagannath Puri who just there's one brother who's just, say, 1 year older than his younger brothers, two or three younger brothers, and the father has expired, so everyone will just simply listen to him. Just very, very, very simple. Very simple. So the family stays together. There may be conveniences, there will be conveniences, there will be inconveniences, but at least they have each other in case of difficulty. So this is simple human life, and it seems so amazing to us. They used to live in joint families. And not only in India, but in other places too. But now, Kali Yuga, quarreling and quarreling, the age of quarrel. So everyone is on their own. And so lonely, and so lonely. So lonely and insecure because they're on their own. They don't even have their family to take care of them in case of difficulty. So horrible. Everyone is on their own. This is one of the symptoms of Kali Yuga, is everyone is on their own, and therefore, because everyone's on their own, you're welcome if you'd like to come in. And because everyone's on their own, they're lonely, insecure, and their minds are disturbed because you have to figure out everything yourself. Any other questions or comments?
Seems amazing that Rukmini can fall into that mindset that I can have a conditioned soul. I was just thinking that maybe that's an indication to us that we shouldn't expect that all that we can become aloof completely, that the mind and our condition is always going to be pulling us that way. But we have to be able, like you're saying, we use strengthen the intelligence so that we can deal with it.
Yes, that's what we should take from it. Mm. That even at this point of the Bhagavatam, this is given to us so that we. And there was I couldn't find it exactly, but it talks about by just unhappiness. It might have been a verse. Unhappiness is destroyed by philosophical discussion, like that. But that's not why Rukmini is doing it. Because according to Jiva Goswami, Rukmini, as Lakshmi Devi herself, you are never touched by any of these in the least. But it is your pastime as a person of this world that you're behaving like this, and in the same manner as my pastime as a person of this world, I am giving you this instruction. I'm taking the position of older brother to instruct you, but you don't need it. This is your pastime. But we need it, which is your point.
So a self-realized soul, somebody who's experiencing the high taste of devotional service, and they won't feel that at all, or will they, in this world?
If you're self-realized, you mean fully self-realized?
Yeah, if you're situated on... You have a taste for devotional service, you're experiencing Bhava. Because according to the verse in the 11th canto, Bhakti Karyation of Bhava, the way as you progress, it's like eating a meal. And the material conditioning.
So, are you asking whether if someone has full spiritual consciousness, is alive in his relationship with Krishna, will he still be affected by the influenced by the material energy in Maya to be thinking in this way?
Yes, if he's in the material world.
If by offense, maybe, but other than that, no. If he's in the. Because Bhava means that his soul is awake to his actual identity. He's awake. It's not fully developed at the stage of Bhava, but he's awake. He knows who he is in relationship with Krishna. So if some cloud of this maybe passed through because he has a material body, maybe, I don't know. But it's not, it's just a cloud passing through if something like that would happen. Just as, say if when a child is watching a movie, he takes it all so seriously. He puts his whole consciousness involved in the movie. But when, if you've seen the same movie 10 times, or if you're the director and you know what's exactly happening, and you saw, or you were in it and you saw it happening, or if you're just an intelligent person, you don't put your mind in it. You may see it going on, but you don't. Your mind doesn't touch it at all, because there's no identification. And what entangles us in the movies is the identification. We want to enjoy it. So when someone doesn't have the enjoying spirit for the material world, he won't become entangled. Is that?
Yeah, he has to be a preacher. I was thinking when you were saying that somebody who was on an Anicara platform, they're actually completely absorbed. Then they won't experience it. That's the philosophy.
An Uttama Bhakta, he doesn't see any difference between people who are inimical and non-inimical. He's seeing everyone is serving Krishna except for him. So there's no, first of all, he's not a preacher. Madhyam is the preaching platform. So Uttama sometimes may act as a Madhyam for a particular purpose. But in general, the Madhyams act as Madhyams.
It just seems like that if it comes down to the Madhyam platform, then he can only preach if he's actually having some experience or is remembering what the material world's like, and therefore he's able to encourage people by proper instruction in their particular position.
Yeah, compassion comes from the Madhyam devotees. The compassionate nature of the Madhyam devotees, due to their previous experience, is what makes them compassionate preachers. Exactly. But you weren't asking if an Uttama comes down to the Madhyam platform, what's his experience? Because you're asking the wrong person if you're asking that. But all I could say is that it's different from my experience, certainly. There's description of the Uttama, what his consciousness is like. Stavaram jagamam dekina dekitara murti savachasava. Hoya isha devas murti. Sees everything in relationship with Krishna as a manifestation of Krishna. His consciousness is fully effulgently awake to Krishna. Krishna is alive at every moment. He doesn't see anything separate from his loving relationship with Krishna and his consciousness. Anything, anyone. His consciousness is fully alive with his love for Krishna. Ishta Deva Smurti sees everything as a manifestation. His consciousness is fully awake. There's no darkness. There's no maya, there's no false ego. Because false ego goes when we give up material energy and we're accepted by the internal energy, which is basically the stage of bhava.
I wanted to ask you regarding the equal vision. Some places it is said that a learned person can see everybody equally, from Chandra the dog to the learned Brahmana, because he sees the spirit soul within.
Or the super soul.
Or the super soul, yes. So, and he sees that there is the same spirit soul inside, the same kind of spirit soul inside. And whatever the external situation is, the result of the choice of these living entities, but even seeing them as spirit soul, they're not equal, because one is doing good choices.
Qualitatively equal.
One is making good choices and the other is making bad choices. So one is worthy of respect and the other...
But he says he sees the equality of all souls. He doesn't... that doesn't mean there's no inequality, but it means he sees the equality of all souls. Just like if you look in the country, in this country here, there are so many people. If you look for the inequality, you'll see there's so many, all you'll see is individuality. But you could also see from the point of view, everyone is an Indian citizen. You can see the true equality of everyone. Something like that. But it doesn't mean that there's no differences if on the practical level. But on the spiritual level, you see those differences as temporary, and who the soul actually is, who that person actually is, who is eternally.
So how does one respect somebody who is making the wrong choices?
One has to act practically, but one should respect them, you know, as the expression goes, from a distance. If they're making choices that would be harmful for you to associate with this, the Bhagavad Gita describes, keep away. But you can keep away and be respectful, but you can see the soul bewildered by the illusory energy and therefore making wrong choices, and you can be respectful. It's not them. It's the material energy that's corrupting their activities. It's not them who's corrupted, because we're also hearing this point that the soul doesn't actually become contaminated by the activities of the material energy, because it's like oil and water, they don't actually mix. It's not that the soul becomes contaminated, the matter doesn't seep into the essence of the soul and contaminate it. It's external to the soul. So that soul who's a part of Krishna is respected. And Krishna doesn't give up his relationship with them. And he respects them so much that he stays with them, regardless of where they are. Even if they're a pig in the sewage water of Vrindavan, Krishna stays with them. And we're going to disrespect them? So it's a disrespect of Krishna too. So that's, and it's so strongly expressed like this, that Krishna is displeased with anyone, even if he's rendering devotional service, but he doesn't respect all living entities, the Lord in their hearts and the soul in their hearts. So that's how important that point is, actually. So yes, they've made a wrong choice. Did you ever have a friend who made a wrong choice? Did you hate the person? Please. Oh, okay, we won't get into what really happened, but well, Krishna's love is so pure that he doesn't reject, even if we make wrong choices, and the devotees reflect that mood. Or they can look at them with their knowledge, with their eye of knowledge, as an adult looks at a naughty child. And doesn't hate the child, just understands the naughty needs some rectification. But were you pushing in a different direction actually?
No, I'm just trying to think. This thing is one saying that Christians say their book for their best of God to lie.
There, that's very handy, isn't it?
What did you say?
There, but for the grace of God, go I. In other words, that one doesn't think that I'm so good, I would never do something as terrible as that. Rather, one thinks that just by the grace of Krishna, it protected me from ending up in that kind of a situation. And once you make a wrong turn, it's just so easy to make other wrong turns too. Once you made some bad choices, land in bad association, everything can go bad. So there, but by the grace of God, go I. So no pride. It's humble. It's glorifying Krishna. I think it's a good one. A very good one. And I think also as one gets older, just this one, you know, someone does something that you think is so terrible, and then we tend to get self-righteous. You know, how dare that person? And then as one gets older and has been through life, and one knows what all the things that one has done that have been less than perfect, one tends to be a little more hesitant at condemning others, at throwing the first stone. But yet sometimes teachers, very, very strong and strict, just to keep the sincere students on this side of the line, even though they're very humble, or else how could Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami Maharaj say that he was lower than the worm, unless he was thinking himself? And if you're like that, how could you condemn others if you think you're a worm? All you could do is condemn those lower than you. You have to only condemn the amoebas and the microbes. And therefore Mahaprabhu's teaching is to give others respect. And you see that in India so much, that people say, "Oh, Maharaj, Maharaj," everyone is Maharaj or something, so they give respect to people. It's naturally, simply. You know, maybe not deeply often, but at least simple. Give everyone, like I find in the West, the system is give everyone less respect than they deserve, and Indians give everyone a little more respect than they deserve. The West, give everyone a little respect, and you have to prove yourself to every single person individually. Because everyone is so, I guess, frustrated or whatever. Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes.
Lord is so merciful that he married Rukmani. Rukmani sent a messenger and this requested once. So what was so special in Rukmani? Many other women wanted to marry Krishna. Krishna chose to marry Rukmani.
See, her prema was so high. It was uniting the goddess of fortune with the Supreme Lord. So that was described earlier, actually, that Krishna had already noted her. He also wanted to marry her even before the letter had arrived. So one can look at it on the level of what was so special about her with her prema. It was almost on the level of the Vrajagopikas. And one could look at it on the level of that she's Krishna's internal energy. So who could have more love than Rukmini Devi for Krishna? So Krishna naturally reciprocated with that.
This gopi is also wanting to marry Krishna. Krishna didn't marry
them. Why?
He had maybe even more prema.
But why didn't he marry them? This is what all the people of Vrindavan were wondering. Oh, they were feeling so sad. Oh, only if Krishna, only if these Braja Gopikas can marry Krishna. Oh, that's what they were thinking. Only if they're perfectly, especially Srimati Radharani. Only if she can marry Krishna. And then when it was organized that she would marry that other person, oh, everyone was so upset. And this laid the stage for the pastimes that were to ensue, organized by Yogamaya. Okay, the next class is given by Narayani Mataji. The next chapter, what's the next chapter? After Krishna marries Rukmini, what's the next chapter? Immediately there is a son born named Pradyumna, and his story is quite amazing. It's quite wonderful. No, this year. Oh, it's next year. No, it's this year. It's this year, December 14th. And then right after that, what Krishna is going to do is something even more amazing. There's the story of the Shamataka jewel, and then he gets two more wives in that. And then he marries five more wives, and then he has eight. And then he kills Bulmasura, and he says, all you 16,100 beautiful princesses can go home. And they said, how can we go home now? And they fixed their eyes on Krishna. And Krishna said, okay, you can come with me. So then Krishna married 16,108 wives, and he was living with all of them in Dwarka. And how did he keep them all happy? Because each of them thought, Krishna loves me so much that he's staying only with me all the time. I've captured him. And then when he had 16,108 wives, he decided to go to Rukmini Devi, his first wife of so long ago, and said, I shouldn't have married you. You shouldn't have married me. It's probably better you go somewhere else. Go ahead. It's all right. You could find someone more qualified. And Rukmini Devi fainted. And then right after that, then there's what's called in the Krishna book, the genealogical table, all the different descendants of the family of Krishna and all his wives. And then right after that, we meet Rukmi again for the last time. Because there's the occasion of the marriage, Krishna had grandchildren at that time. So Aniruddha was marrying the granddaughter of Rukmi. And how could this be arranged? So Rukmi was, so they were all gathered together for the marriage ceremony, and Rukmi tried to cheat Krishna, to give Balaram trouble. He was a little afraid of Krishna by this time. And Balaram became upset, and Balaram killed him. And we will become so happy when that happens. Even though we are non-violent by nature, we will become so happy. And then Usha calls for Aniruddha in a wonderful way. And then Banasura is killed. So we have so much to look forward to. And then the Yadu princes see a lizard in a well, and they cannot get him out. But Krishna extends his what?
Oh.
He touches him, does he? He touches him with his hand? A big lizard, yeah? And then that lizard turns into King Riga. And then, right after that, there's a happy time, because Balaram goes back to Vrindavan. And everyone is so happy. And then when Balaram goes to Vrindavan, Pandraka attacks, then Balaram, while he's dancing, kills Vidvida, and then on and on it goes. So there's much to look forward to, wonderful pastimes. 5, 6, 7. Oh! Touch him. Quickly, touch it, touch him with your hand and see what happens. See if he turns into a great king. Or his tail might fall off. One of the two. They're so cruel, these creatures. They have no consciousness practically. All they see is bugs. And they just, and sometimes they even eat each other. Swallow each other. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They just, the little, huh? Huh? The little ones. Yeah, they're cruel. This is what the animal world is like. Let's not be that again. Let's go home. We can treat them with all respect, saying, oh, what a nice servant of Krishna is in there. But as they say in contemporary language in English, let's not go there. Okay, see you soon. Hare Krishna.